Welcome to Community Alert. Not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams, keeping you informed on how to get ready and be prepared. Tuesdays at 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. and Saturdays at 1 p.m. on AM 1290, the Santa Barbara News Press radio station.
Hey, folks, welcome to another edition of Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And today we're visiting with an old friend, Ronnie Coleman, who's a former state fire marshal. He's here to talk with us about some of the new things that have been emerging in the fire field. And we're glad to have him with us. Good morning, Ronnie.
Good morning. I'm delighted to be here.
Glad you could make it with us. Got a couple of quick announcements here before we get into today's program. Santa Barbara City is working on the Advanced Cert Academy courses. This will be taught throughout the year, starting January 14th all the way through December 9th. For further information, if you're interested in Advanced Cert training, give Yoli a call at 965-5254, 965-5254, and that'll be one class a month. Also, tomorrow at Santa Barbara City College West Campus, City of Santa Barbara and Santa Barbara City College Earthquake Exercise Plan will be put into effect. This is going to be a live and real drill. Purpose of the drill is to provide participants an opportunity to evaluate current response concepts, plans, and capabilities in the event of a major earthquake in the city and Santa Barbara City College that includes disruption of utilities, transportation, and communication. The exercise will focus on emergency operation, activation, and coordination, communication, and integration of local, state, and federal assets necessary to save lives and protect health following a major earthquake. This will be tomorrow. It starts early morning. It'll go till at least noon. We'll have a bit of an impact on parking on the West Campus. They're also going to have numerous victims all in moulage, so it's going to look like the real deal. If you're in the area, just be aware that it is a drill. This again tomorrow on January 7th. Interestingly enough, and we can get into this with Chief Coleman, sale, use, and fireworks in Lompoc, focus of Tuesday's City Council meeting with fire and police chiefs seeking the ban. Meeting is scheduled between 5:30, will begin at 5:30 at the City Council Chambers in Lompoc, 100 Civic Center Plaza. Chief, fireworks are a big issue in California. We were talking about this just the other day when we were together. It's interesting that there's still some cities out there that are selling fireworks.
Well, that's very true. It's not exactly a new issue, though, Mike. It's been around for 50, 60 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, fireworks, I don't think the public is aware that fireworks are such a problem in California.
Well, it depends on what you're talking about defining the problem. There are two types of fireworks involved in this discussion, what is commonly referred to by state regulation as what we call safe and sane fireworks, mm-hmm. and then there are illegal fireworks. And if you want to know what the difference is, if it flies through the air or it goes boom, it's illegal. If it's got a state label on it that says it's recognized as a safe and sane by the state fire marshal's office, then it operates under our regulation scheme.
But that doesn't mean that they are legal in certain areas. Obviously, they don't allow those, even the certified fireworks in some areas. Is that true?
It's true, because California is what we call a local control state. Every community has the right to choose its own code adoption processes, mm-hmm. and make amendments according to what we refer to as the findings of fact, mm-hmm. meaning their topography, their geography, and their economic conditions, mm-hmm. and therefore communities do have the right to limit even safe and sane.
Now, it's interesting, the fireworks. I know that at the state level, how to get rid of confiscated fireworks has become a monolithic challenge in how to transport them, how to dispose of them. The Environmental Protection Agency gets involved. You can't just burn them. You can't just give them back. You can't just throw them in the ocean. It's challenging what to do with this stuff.
So
it's a serious challenge to our state fire marshal's office.
I'll bet.
Right.
Are there any municipalities or regions that allow illegal fireworks?
No.
No. So it's only the safe and sane that are up. They're considering right now whether or not whether to accept them or not in Lompoc, I guess.
What they're probably, I don't know what's going on in Lompoc per se, because I'm not involved in mm-hmm. that communications, but I would tell you what generally happens is that there is almost always an issue of the organizations that make their annual funding from fireworks sales,
right.
And they would like to be able to retain the right to sell safe and sane. They are not involved in illegal fireworks. They're not supporting illegal fireworks. They're probably voting on the right for those organizations to continue sale.
Oh, exactly. Correct. And many nonprofits that are involved in fundraising select fireworks as a method to raise funding. And, of course, there's sales tax involved, so the local government receives some of that. So it's a controversial issue. While it has some simple discussion topics, the solutions actually get quite complicated. So let's move into some other bullets here for the day. I had something come across the wire just yesterday from the U.S. Fire Administration. Civilian residential fire fatality notices for the period of December 28th through January 30th. The number caught my surprise. There were 70 people killed in 1 week from fires involving 29 different states and a total of 58 different incidents. Chief, what type of trends and patterns are we seeing? I mean, on one hand, when you look at the total population of the United States, this isn't even a significant drip. If you look at the fact that we've done so well in the reduction of fire since we started keeping statistics, almost a 45-degree angle line straight down, this seems like a high number.
Well, the way I'm going to answer that, Mike, is that it's kind of a relative number. Yes, it's probably high. It's probably startling. If someone said, we're going to lose 70 of your neighbors in the next 1 week, you'd probably be terrorized by that. But you spread that 70 out over 50 states, and then take into consideration that some of them are what we call MFIs, or multiple fatality incidents.
Correct.
18 of the people were in MFIs. These trends and patterns continue to plague us because of the fact that the residential occupancy remains the most dangerous occupancy for anybody to be involved with. I go back to the 1960s when we were saying something like 75% of our fatalities all occurred in single-family dwellings. The number hasn't really changed that much. I think what is interesting to me from my perspective is the fact that as you look at those numbers, there are questions that pop into my mind. A good example would be it talks about the fact that over 65 was almost half that number. Well, over 65 is a class that really needs fire protection because they're usually either limited ambulatory or they're limited supervision or whatever the case may be. And yet we can't tell by looking at the number whether those people lived in rest homes, whether those fires occurred in, you know, single-family dwellings, et cetera. And we have to examine the in-depth information, not just the demographic breakdown.
Correct. And to be fair, that's exactly right. And to get that specific information, folks that are interested can go to usfa@service.gov/delivery.com, and you can click on all sorts of links. It'll give you the actual specifics to each one of those incidents,
right?
Because there's too many potential variables.
A lot of variables. The number one variable to me, and when I read numbers like this, is how many of those people were lost in homes that had a working smoke detector? And how many of those were lived in homes in which there was a malfunction of a smoke detector? And moreover, how many of those homes were protected by residential sprinklers?
And you mentioned smoke detectors. We every chance we get, we push the issue of smoke detectors. And also the fact that smoke detectors have a lifespan on them, and folks don't really appreciate that they're only good for about 10 years, at which point you need to switch them out. And so in Santa Barbara, a lot of the homes here have certainly passed the 10-year mark. You need to go check your smoke detectors, see when they were last installed. And this includes the permanent ones. They need to get changed out. They're not expensive. It's amazingly inexpensive. You can go to Gray Bar and get them for less than $10 a pop.
Right.
That'd be for electrical hardwired ones. But in any event, let's get into the discussion of the day, and that is the Tampa 2 report. We're coming into our break, but why don't we just introduce what is the NIFF Tampa 2 report, and we'll come back after the break and get into the meat of it.
Sure. You want me to explain what Tampa 2 is?
Please.
Well, we have a trend, using your words or from earlier, we have a trend and pattern of the fact that we're doing everything we possibly can to reduce firefighter death and injury. And there's a group that's referred to as the National Fallen Firefighter Foundation that back about 10 years ago sponsored a workshop in Tampa called Tampa 1, in which we developed these strategic initiatives for people to follow to reduce firefighter death. Tampa 2 is called Carrying the Safety Messages into the Future. It deals with two things. One is how much progress have we made in 10 years, and how much more do we have to do?
And with that, we're into our first break, visiting today with former California State Fire Marshal Ronnie J. Coleman, with Ted Adams, Mike Williams, and the ever-diligent Richard Dugan watching the clock for us on Community Alert, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster on KCSB AM 1290, live on the internet at newspress.com.
Welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And today we're visiting with an old friend, Ronnie Coleman, former state fire marshal, and talking about some of the issues that are before the fire community. And today, Mike.
Well, Chief, let's get into what Tampa 1 was. Let's review that a little bit, and then we'll phase into Tampa 2.
Okay, well, you have to kind of go back 10 years if you really want to put this in context. And what Tampa 1 was a meeting where they brought together a bunch of people from the fire service to talk about the terrible track record we have of firefighters and line-of-duty deaths. The group, headed by Ron Sarnicky, who's the executive director, back in March of 2004, got together and they started asking really tough questions about what's going wrong. Why are people dying at the scene of fires? What are some of the issues that are resulting in lifetime health issues for firefighters? Because, as you probably know, heart attacks and carcinogens and things of that nature are very much a part of firefighter fatalities. So Tampa 1 was essentially an inventory of problems. And there was a tremendous document that came out of it, because this document identified some strategic initiatives that local fire departments could take. It all had to do with individual behavior, but it also had to do with organizational behavior. So what they did is they came up with this set of initiatives and started proposing that fire departments treat things differently. I'll give you a classic example. Is they're really strong on seatbelts, because the number of firefighters who are killed by being ejected from the fire vehicle was pretty high. So they're big on seatbelts. They're big on heart disease. They're big on carcinogens and things of that nature. And the objective, of course, was to reduce the number of people that actually suffered loss of life as a result of being a firefighter.
So then they moved into Tampa, too. So that was a 10-year distance there, and then they reviewed what had happened?
Yeah, the one thing you have to remember is that Tampa 2 is not the second event. It's actually the third event. There was an intervening effort in Novato, California many years ago. I think it was about 5 years ago. It was sponsored by Fireman's Fund Insurance, where they hosted a meeting to bring the group together. So Tampa 2 is not the second meeting. It's actually the third meeting. The idea behind this meeting was to talk about the next 10 years. It was kind of I would call it like rebooting your computer. Go back and start all over again and take a look at the strategic initiatives and say, are we making any progress? Are we showing any significant change in the fire service? What's changed? What changes can we foresee in the next 10 years, et cetera? And it just strengthens the life safety initiatives.
Well, for folks that are interested in this, I'm working off an email from the International Code Council, but I think if you went to Dr. Google and typed in NFFF, that's three Fs, Tampa 2 report,
right,
you'd probably get a quick hit, and you could download this. It's a rather comprehensive document. You can kind of follow along to what we're talking about. So where are the trends? What are we starting to see? Are people paying attention? Have some of the safety policies and procedures and training worked, or are we stagnant?
Well, I'm not quite sure how I'm going to answer that question. I don't want to set myself up as an authority on the outcome of this, because I was a participant, but I was not the person who actually formed the recommendations or the conclusions. And so the thing that I'm going to give you is the feedback I had by actually being there and listening to what was going on. I think what I picked up initially was that the 16 life safety initiatives have started to make a difference. The total numbers have not dropped drastically, but they have dropped. And certain areas we have seen significant improvement in. Most importantly, what I saw going on there was the fact that they're going to start changing the way the messages go out. As you and I know, we've talked about this before, we now live in a world of internet and social media that's drastically different than the world was 10 years ago. And the manner in which this is being done changes the way that the National Fallen Firefighter is going to be, organization is going to be communicating to its constituency. A lot more of it's going to be based upon current technology rather than the old-fashioned way of putting a poster up on the bulletin board and then hoping things got better.
Well, it says here, report highlights, fire prevention can no longer be an afterthought. We must incorporate prevention and initial and ongoing firefighter training and develop more succinctly based effective fire and life safety education programs that resonate with the public. Fire service leaders must promote and support model building and fire codes and residential sprinklers, including initiatives for home builders. And that was out of the first initiative, Tampa, and then they almost word for word included it again in Tampa 2. And that takes us to the future. How are we going to accomplish this?
Well, I think that the thing that you got to remember is that sprinklers were not the only thing that were brought out of the out of this. Public education, which is Initiative 14, was also moved forward with the idea that the education of the community and the education of property owners and homeowners, et cetera, is almost as important as any other form of communications to the fire service. I'll answer question 15 by saying that the reason I think it remains in there is this is an ongoing project that's far from being complete yet. We've seen some very significant successes in residential sprinklers over the last 10 years. I don't have any ready to reveal numbers, but I can tell you that there are hundreds of thousands of homes now protected by sprinklers that were never sprinklered 10 years ago. And I think the reason this one stays in here, and I'm going to draw a conclusion that's my conclusion only. I don't want to say that this is from the National Fallen Firefighter. But the reason sprinklers have been left in here is the realization that fires are different today than they were 20 years ago. This is represented by the work being done by UL and by NIST and so forth. And that if we don't control a residential fire within the first 5 minutes, that the remainder of those other initiatives cannot do anywhere near as much to reduce the fire loss as the assigning of sprinklers.
Well, and that makes that's a huge process there in order to get to an incident within 5 minutes and have some kind of effective response. That's challenging.
Well, of course, most fire departments would like to have a five-minute response time 90% of the time. That comes out of the standards of cover methodology.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is that we're not quite sure we can do that all the time, every time. And there are fire departments that have put a tremendous effort into improving their response time, but they still have one thing that has to happen before the fire department can do anything. You know what that one thing is, Mike?
What's that?
Somebody's got to discover the fire and call the fire department. Otherwise, we're sitting in a fire station waiting to be asked.
Well, we certainly see that argument when we look at the large metropolitan areas that are having challenges processing the 911 calls.
Okay, well, then let's also go back and look at those 70 people who you talked about earlier, or we talked about earlier, and ask the question of what stage was the fire in when the fire department arrived on scene for those occupancies. I would be willing to bet you. In fact, I've been on enough fires to almost say I'd bet a steak dinner on this, that the buildings were well involved before the fire department ever got there.
Oh, absolutely. I would have to agree with you. With that, we're coming up to our next break, visiting today with former California State Fire Marshal Ronnie J. Coleman. Want to promote the website, all of his articles, all the way back to the early 60s, available free of charge at cafsti.net. That's cafsti.net, and it's Table Talk with Ronnie J. Coleman. On Community Alert, Ted Adams, Mike Williams will be back in just a minute on KZSB AM 1290 Santa Barbara.
Hey,
Hey, folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. Today, we're visiting with Ronnie Coleman, former state fire marshal and many-time guest on this program.
Chief, let's getting back into this. Initiative 15 actually is that advocate must be strengthened for the enforcement of codes and installation of home fire sprinklers. Can we expand on that just a little bit? Advocacy must be strengthened for the enforcement of codes and the installation of home fire sprinklers.
Well, what Ron's group is essentially saying there is that built-in fire protection cannot just happen in a vacuum. It requires the support of people who are well-informed, knowledgeable, and capable of using this technology to reduce the number of fires that result in deaths in single-family dwellings. For example, there's another project which is not alluded to in this report called Vision 2020, mm-hmm. which talks about community risk assessment, and where sprinklers really begin to become recognized for their value is when you do a community risk assessment profile. And when you begin to find out, you know, where are your most vulnerable people? Where are your most vulnerable occupancies? It's an unfortunate situation, and I don't know how to characterize this other than just call it what it is. It's an unfortunate situation that the people who probably need fire protection the most have the least resources to provide protection, and that's people who live in low-cost housing and people who live in apartment houses and things of this nature. So what they're basically saying here is that there must be people in the community who are advocates for using this stuff to control fire to that first 5 minutes. If anybody goes back and even reads the code, for example, NFPA 13D, which is the standard for residential sprinklers, was originally designed to stop the fire for 10 minutes, period. 10 minutes. It didn't say they were going to save the building. It didn't say that everything was going to be hunky-dory. It said, save the building for 10 minutes so people can get out. And that relates back to Initiative 14, which has to do with public awareness and public advocacy. I just wrote an article, because I do columns at other magazines, and one of them is called Sprinkler Age. I just wrote a column about the fact that if you turn on television tonight and sit and start looking at the kinds of things that they're selling by television, it's everything from vitamins to make sure you live longer, to Viagra so you can have a better social life. And the issue is I haven't seen a single sprinkler ad on internet on national television. And that's because nobody is using that media to inform the public. Does that make any sense?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because I'm in the process of buying a sprinkler system myself for my project, and I know Ted's doing the same thing.
That's your remodel, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a remodel, and but that in California, as you know, that's required. I have no objection to it, but I have an inside track. I know who to call, and I know what we're looking for. I'm not sure that the average Mr. and Mrs. Cleaver knows what to do or where to go, and I think that gets into the education aspect of it. When we talk about sprinklers, what are we really talking about, and how much does it really cost, and what do I, as a future homeowner or builder, I'm owner-builder in my case, but if I got a contractor doing it, what do I have to anticipate? What are the challenges?
Yeah, there are a lot of advocacy groups that are doing an outstanding job on this. There are several coalitions that are aimed at this effort on a nationwide basis. There are several organizations that provide public information, DVDs, etc. In order for public education to really be more successful on this one topic, we have to overcome the apathy of the communities at large. You know what? Unless you're a firefighter yourself, you probably have this attitude. My home is my castle, and it's never going to burn down. If there's anybody going to burn down anything in this neighborhood, it's going to be my neighbor. It's not going to be me. But then you turn around and look at the statistics of 70 people dying. I mean, if 70 people crashed an airplane, it'd be on the headlines of every newspaper in the United States. But not when you do it one and two at a time.
Well, it's interesting that they highlight here in bold print One of the concerns by the group is to continue to enhance the fire service involvement in the codes and the standards process. They want to make sure that, the attention isn't just so much on sprinklers that we overlook the fact that there's other factors involved in the fire prevention, fire protection, risk management aspect of, residential fires.
Well, unfortunately, in many fire departments, prevention and suppression are often considered as right hand and left hand.
Right.
And what I always tell everybody is just remember when we put your hands together to pray, that you both have to be there to support the idea.
Yeah. Well, I've always looked at the fire prevention and code enforcement as actually firefighter safety issues. And that is the eyes and ears of the prevention guys, the engineers, the people that understand the construction process going in before there's a problem to protect the interest not only of the property owner and the community as a large, but the firefighters that may or may not have to go in there under adverse conditions. And I know in California, the law is clear in this now that you can be held liable for the injuries of public safety personnel on your property if it's not to code, it's not in compliance, and things happen. And so it's actually there to protect you, the property owner, as well.
That's true. As a matter of fact, that's why Initiative 14 and 15 are in here. The thing I'm really impressed with the National Fallen Firefighter Foundation is they didn't take the traditional route to the recommendations like let's just keep doing this or let's just keep doing that. Like they are taking a non-traditional approach, which is let's start doing things differently. They're not saying, for example, they expect an overnight success. What they're expecting is people's behavior to change. I have often said, and I really believe this, that people who live in apartment houses are better protected than people who live in McMansions. Because most of the apartment houses these days are being fully sprinklered, but the McMansions may or may not be.
Mm-hmm.
And who is the wiser of the two? Well, the people in the apartment building probably don't even know that much about sprinkler protection. They just know that they got some device hanging in their bedroom. Whereas the other decision of putting them in to a large single-family dwelling often gets really political. And a lot of bad information and actually wrong information has been put out about sprinklers.
Well, one of the things that I notice, Ron, in this whole situation is that people have a tendency to think that if your fire sprinklers go off, every sprinkler in the house goes off. And I'm surprised how pervasive that is. People don't understand that it takes a flame to a heat source to turn on a sprinkler head. And they feel like they're just going to lose everything in their house to water damage if they have a system.
Well, I call that the MacGyver effect because that's where the story got started, was on one of those MacGyver things where he set off every sprinkler head to cause him to be able to escape some prison or something. Anybody that believes anything they see on television needs to have their head examined.
Yep.
Anyway.
Yep.
I would second that. One of the greatest advocates that we've run into in the 8 years that we've been on the air about sprinklers was Milt Larson, the owner of the Magic Castle.
Yep.
And I know you two I introduced you to, and you've since spoken. But he was somewhat not interested, I guess would be a polite way to say, putting sprinklers in the Magic Castle. And he did, and it saved the Magic Castle when there was a fire up on the third floor. And what a great advocate for the sprinkler industry.
I used him in an article for Sprinkler Age magazine. He's what I call foxhole mentality. And what foxhole mentality is, a lot of people get religion when they're being shot at. And the same thing applies to people whose houses burn down. They go, God, I wish I had of done this, and I wouldn't have lost my home. Well, Milt was, he was a very funny guy to talk to, by the way. Very opinionated, but very strong in his beliefs. But now that he understands what was at risk, and I'll go back to my term about Vision 2020 and risk assessment at the local level, once you identify risk, the sprinklers are an obvious tool to solve it.
With that, we're up to our next break with visiting today with retired California State Fire Marshal Ronnie J. Coleman. His articles and interviews available at CAFSTI.net. That's CAFSTI.net under Table Talk with Ronnie J. Coleman. This is Community Alert with Ted Adams, Mike Williams, Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster, live at newspress.com on KZSB AM 1290.
Hey, folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And today we're visiting with Ronnie Coleman, who's been on the show many times.
Oh, yes.
And former fire marshal, and we're talking a bit about code today.
Also, I should promote it, the video Past, Present, and or I should say Wildfire Past, Present, and Future with Ronnie Coleman and Kate Dargan, also former state fire marshal, available at wildlandresidents.org and also at CAFSTI.net. That's a very popular video talking about, it goes all the way back to the 1910 fires. So
is there any charge for that?
No, it's all free.
Outstanding.
Absolutely free. A reminder, Santa Barbara City College and City of Santa Barbara, Fire Police, Public Works, all involved in a significant exercise tomorrow, live exercise, Santa Barbara City College at the West Campus. This will be tomorrow between, I'd say probably about 8 and noon. A lot of emergency vehicles over there, the media, as well as numerous victims in moulage. So it's going to look like the real deal. May have a little bit of an impact on parking on the West Campus. Again, this is tomorrow with the City of Santa Barbara. Chief, getting back into the Initiative 14, public education must receive more resources and be championed as a critical fire and life safety program. Certainly, Community Alert, that's the whole purpose of why we're here. We try to approach the fire public safety issues from all the different angles that we can come up with, bringing in opposing points of view and guests that support those. We're doing our little part. What works and what doesn't work as you look back over the last 10 to 20 years?
Oh, boy. How much more time do we have left on the show?
We got about 18 minutes.
Okay, well, we're going to have to limit my response then, because the only thing that really works, and this is going to sound a little hokey, but you asked me an open-ended question, I'm going to give you an open-ended answer. The only thing that really works is persistence.
Okay.
There's no magic bullet. There's no way that you can say, well, we're going to do this, and then everything's going to be hunky-dory. I jokingly refer to code development as a process by which we continue to know more and more about less and less until pretty soon we have regulations for everything. And sprinkler systems falls into a category of being a partnership of the community, a partnership of the fire department, the building department, the water department. There are so many moving parts that the only way that it ever gets to the surface is somebody decides that they're going to stick to their guns. And I call these people prevention heroes. There are, by the way, very few statues to fire prevention people in squares around the United States. Almost all the statues show a fireman holding a baby in their arm with a helmet on and with an axe in their hand. And I've never seen a statue yet shows a fire inspector with a clipboard. The advocates have to be persistent. They got to stick to their guns, even if they don't get all sorts of recognition. They have a target and a goal, and they stick to their story until they achieve it.
Well, it's their job, for gosh sakes. That's what they get paid for.
Well, I look at it from the law enforcement side, it'd be like burglary prevention.
Yeah.
If you can get your community to lock the doors and put some lights in and do some hedge trimming and to be alert of suspicious vehicles and stuff, you can really have a dramatic impact on your burglary rate. Does that mean the cops aren't doing anything when there's no more burglaries? Certainly not. But it's the same kind of thing. It's hard to keep it fresh in people's mind in a productive way.
Well, I think if you go back and look at the work done by the National Fallen Firefighters, you'll find that on their section on public education, they're talking a lot about outreach. They're talking about getting social media involved. They're talking about using the community policing model in terms of community education. They're talking about integrating community risk reduction at the fire company level. One of my other metaphors I've often used is the fire station is sort of like a business franchise. You've got a territory and you've got a customer list.
Mm-hmm.
And those departments that sit in their fire station waiting for a fire to occur will probably have fires. But those departments that get out of the fire station and go out and start soliciting input and working with people in the community, the number of fires can possibly be reduced. Now, this almost always raises a serious concern to the firefighters, like, well, are we going to be put out of business? Well, I'll put it to you this way. If we were going to be put out of business, that would have occurred 100 years ago when sprinklers were first invented. There are too many other variables in our community for any one particular solution to eliminate the need for a fire department. My witness right now is 70 people who died in that short period of time.
Absolutely. Well, we also know that the insurance industry, one of the first questions they ask is, where's the closest fire station?
So that's where the closest fire hydrant is. And I used to laugh about that because I asked an insurance agent one day, what happens to that fire hydrant if a fire truck never shows up?
Well, exactly. I mean, the questionnaire list that the insurance companies have now has gotten rather extensive. Not only do they want to know where the closest hydrant is, they want to know where the closest fire department is, and then the type of apparatus that comes and what their response time is, as well as how many people are on that apparatus.
Yep.
And, of course, that's a variable number of issues there, none of which necessarily are going to come up the same each time. It's being asked. One of the issues I think here that's worthy of discussion before we have to go is one of the provisions was to provide more resources, both time and money, for code enforcement at the company level.
Right.
Most departments that I'm aware of are not particularly enthralled with the idea of going out and with the clipboard and doing inspections. They'll do them if they have to, but they don't really get into the nuts and bolts, and they don't do much more than look for the fire extinguishers and, you know, the quickie stuff. How are we going to get that trend to change without a revolt within the ranks?
Well, I certainly don't want to cause a revolution in our ranks, but I would like to point out that at one point in time, the fire departments used to do home fire inspections on a very regular basis. I can even give you the era, the 1940s and the 1950s. I can also tell you that many fire departments got into the commercial inspection work and started inspecting commercial buildings in the 60s and 70s. Then something happened, and when I tell you what happened, it's kind of interesting because it's a mutually contradictory problem. Many of our departments then went into the EMS business in the 70s with the rise of the paramedic program, and the number of medical aides started impacting the fire department's distribution and deployment so much that many of those home fire inspection programs just disappeared. I can tell you right now, I can go back to many fire departments that had active company inspection programs that will tell you right now, I just don't have time to do that. So now I'm speaking only for myself. You asked me for my opinion, so I got to be real careful that this is not anybody else's opinion, is that we ought to be doing everything we possibly can to create a reserve corps to the fire service to do home inspections and risk inspections in our communities that reduces the potential for ignition of fire. I don't think we can really ask much more out of our guys and gals who are going on 20 calls a day.
Well, no, and I don't advocate for that either. And you and I've had these discussions into the wee hours of the morning driving about California.
Right.
There are certainly solutions to this. They're new, they're different, they're innovative, but it's certainly the trend is reality, and that's one of the things we want to talk about is the future. When we come back from the break, I'm going to cut short here so we have a little bit more time to talk about the future. Visiting today with California State Fire Marshal retired Ronnie J. Coleman, Ted Adams, Mike Williams on Community Alert. KZSB AM 1290.
Hey, folks, welcome back to Community Alert, our last segment of the show. Today, I'm Ted Adams, my co-host is Mike Williams, and today we're visiting with Ronnie Coleman, former state fire marshal. Mike.
Well, Chief, let's get into problems and solutions. We've got about 6 minutes here.
Okay. Well, the first thing I'd like to comment about this is actions speak louder than words. And we have a lot of people who meet and have a really good time developing documents, and they fill the walls up with posters. But who really cares if they're not going to do anything about it? And the one thing I really admire about the Fallen Firefighter Group is that they get real specific about their problems and their solutions. This particular report says there's five main problem areas for the fire service. That's standardization and certification of our personnel, better data and research dissemination, better implementation of the fire and life safety initiatives at the fire station level, health and fitness overall, and then, of course, risk management. And what I think is appropriate for at least this conversation is that anything we can do to support the actions being taken by these groups is going to move the material along in a positive direction.
Well, I think one of the advantages the fallen firefighters have is that failure is permanent, and that for them, they're taking it from a little different perspective than, say, the code councils or the local fire marshals or the risk management folks. And so there's a little bit more incentive, I think, to make sure that some of this stuff actually works, because it's their people, it's all of us, that are going to suffer the consequences of failure.
Well, one of my standing jokes, and I've used that term several times here, but whenever I start talking to people about NFFF and they give me a blank stare, I already know we've got a problem. But, and I'm talking about fire service people. If I say, do you guys know what NFFF means? And they go, oh, isn't that the stuff you use to fight flammable liquids? No. That's AFFF. What NFFF stands for is National Fallen Firefighter Foundation, and it's aimed at saving your life. So you better be paying attention to it.
Well, you know, when you go to the National Memorial there at Emmitsburg, it's an eye-opener to see all those names there and recognize that not everybody there needs to be there.
That's true.
So any closing thoughts as we close? Because I know you got a teleconference coming up at high noon.
Yes, I do. I got another conference call having to do with fire protection, which is the same topic here. My only suggestion is, well, I have no idea what your actual viewing or listening audience does after we have these discussions, but I'm certainly hoping that they would be in, at least motivated to go on to the National Fallen Firefighter website and download Tampa 2, Carrying the Safety Messages into the Future. It's a book that if I was a fire captain, I'd have it in my firehouse. I'd have it in the hands of all of my firefighters. And if I was a battalion chief at the battalion level like I was in Costa Mesa, I'd make sure every one of my captains had a copy of this. Because what they're basically saying is, and I'll use a phrase I used when we started this, is actions speak louder than words. Just looking at it doesn't make a difference. Just reading it doesn't make a difference. It's what you choose to do and the decisions you choose to change your behavior that are going to make a difference.
Well, I will take heed of that. I will make sure that a copy of that is posted at wildlandresidents.org next to the link to this a copy of this show, as well as posting it on your table talk with Ronnie J. Coleman. Keep everything together. And, of course, people can also pull it off of Dr. Google. Well, Chief, thank you very much. I want to give you time to get situated for your next call. Thank you for taking time out to be with us today.
Yeah, so long, Ron.
Yeah, pleasure being with you guys again.
All right. Take care. So there you have it. Codes, sprinklers, further development. Let's get organized and figure out. But I'm with you about over-enforcement and lack of training of some of the people
well,
on the other end of it.
Well, it destroys the credibility of the organization when the man on the street realizes that he's being taken advantage of by these codes and regulations that shouldn't be enforced.
Well, there's as with everything, there's agendas, and there's people trying to profiteer. There's places to put sprinklers, and there's places not to put sprinklers. And there's ordinances written at local levels that aren't necessarily substantiated by tangible facts. Fire marshals don't all agree on everything. The level of training along the way, you've got people that are full-blown engineers, and you've got people that have taken specialty classes, and that's opposite ends of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And in between all of that, you've got all these various committees and codes and code councils and commissions and what have you that come up and dream these things up that have to be then codified and put to practice. And I don't know, frankly, how the construction trades keep up with all the changes and the people that are charged with enforcing it. I don't see how you can do it.
Well, it changes so fast that you're working to bring one code into effect, and you find out there's another code that's overridden it, and mm-hmm. then you have to change horses and work on it. It's very frustrating to the enforcement folks.
So, and I'm sympathetic to that, to the point that it's a no-win situation for pretty much everything. But in the end, the thing that irritates most of us is how much it all costs, and that's a discussion for another day.
Yeah.
I've already been ragged on, and people complaining that I talk too much about the building permitting process. But when you have to start paying for it, your attention gets finally focused.
Yeah, so, very fine.
Well, with that, we're up to the end of the show. Thank you very much for listening. First show of the 2015 year. Ted, thank you very much.
Thank you, man.
Richard, thank you again for another successful year last year. I appreciate it. And with that, we'll fade on out into the sunset on Community Alert with Ted Adams. Mike Williams, Richard Dugan on the board. Not If But When, Positive Preparation for Disaster. Live at newspress.com on KZSB AM 1290, your Santa Barbara News Press Radio.
Community Alert is produced by the Wildland Residents Association, San Marcos Pass Volunteer Fire Department, with funding provided by a grant from the Cooperative Fire Program of the U.S. Forest Service, Department of Agriculture, Pacific Southwest Region, through the California Fire Safe Council, with additional funding provided by the Fire Services Training Institute. The views and conclusions contained in this program are those of the hosts and guests and should not be interpreted as representing the opinions or policies of the California Fire Safe Council, U.S. Forest Service, the U.S. government, or this station. Any mention of trade names or commercial products does not constitute their endorsement by the California Fire Safe Council or the U.S. government. Commercial use or rebroadcast is prohibited. For further information, call 805-964-7194 or visit wildlandresidents.org. Technical assistance provided by Richard Dugan, Jim Williams, and Mark A. Ward. The WRA and this station are equal opportunity providers.